Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real. And we're live. Oh, I'm so excited. Hi, Sophia. How are you today?
Hi, Izzy. I'm doing great. How about you?
Super stoked to have you on here. When we opened TKS Global, when I was still working at TKS, everyone was so excited to have your application in because you brought such great gratitude and joy into the world. And undoubtedly, you've gone on to do amazing things. And you kind of, you stand for an amazing example of someone who just loves biology, who loves what we can do with this technology. Now you're a researcher at Stanford, which is super impressive. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what your research work is right now and where you started from and where you want to go?
Okay, yeah, super excited to be sharing this. And I would love to share some of those, I guess, very initial moments of my journey in TKS. So I became interested in biotech a few years ago by watching a video about CRISPR. And, you know, at the beginning, it was a lot of just watching more videos, sort of reading papers. But I guess the really changing moment, I like to say it in a kind of a funny way, was because of Twitter. I just decided to create an account because I thought it'd be cool to get to read people's thoughts in real time and to get access to that almost life knowledge. And one day I saw this tweet by David Sinclair, an aging or longevity researcher, and he posted this picture with Nina Kara, who is another TKS alum. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. There are actually other young people in the world interested in these things. So I just reached out to her, learned about TKS, and eventually here I am. What I'm currently working on at the Brophy Lab in Stanford is developing better engineering tools, genetic engineering tools for plants. So one project we have is how do we express this Cas9 enzyme in a transient, meaning non-permanent way in plants, so it can get faster through the regulatory process and it doesn't make so many off-target effects in the plant. And, you know, apart from that, I'm interested in the sustainable textiles industry. So how can we make fibers, for example, cotton fibers, in a less resource-consuming way and also in a more timely, less time to get those going. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
It's incredible. It's amazing because you're clearly very smart and you clearly know a lot about these tools, but it doesn't stop there for you. It's like, okay, now that we have these tools, what can we do with them? And obviously sustainable textiles is, I think, one of the most underlooked, I mean, maybe you disagree, but one of those underlooked areas of climate action and just our economy and being able to circularize it and being able to reduce the off-target effects. And I think maybe the one of the things that you and I both really enjoy is using these technologies in a way that actually moves the needle with change and not just saying, hey, everyone go vegan or hey, everyone do this behavioral change. But why don't we start with, I usually like to start these interviews asking people about a mindset that they're relying on recently. So maybe we can talk about, in the scope of this research project and getting to work on the cutting edge of these new CRISPR and bioengineering techniques, what's a mindset that you've been relying on?
I think this is where I go to the personal development side of myself. And this mindset, I would call it more, it starts with self-awareness. So noticing that the first few weeks that I was here, it was, of course, very exciting, but at the same time, very scary at times to think that there's some theoretical knowledge that I have, some things that I've done as an amateur biohacker in my kitchen. But ultimately, I've never worked at a research lab of this kind, so there are many things for me to learn. And I guess another mindset that sort of intersects with that is a growth mindset. So the first few weeks I had a very fixed mindset, the opposite of that. I was like, I'm already supposed to know these things and I'm making all these mistakes, like, you know, sort of creating this narrative. But then eventually I, you know, realizing this through the self-awareness, either writing, reflecting, talking with friends, family members and so on, sort of figuring this out. I was like, well, it doesn't matter. Like, whatever I don't know, I can learn. Whatever skills I don't have, I can acquire. So, yes, that's been a very important mindset. And then that the result of that, I would say, is confidence. It's like the output. Yeah.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you've learned on the job, like technical lab techniques or analytical tools? Tell me about some of those.
Well, interestingly, it starts with sort of things that we could now see as very simple since everybody has talked about them during COVID, like PCR, how to do a PCR, how to culture bacteria, how to design a plasmid, how to design a Gibson assembly, Golden Gate assembly, how to run a gel electrophoresis, how to analyze sequencing results. How to analyze CRISPR results through tools that other researchers have created, and that it can, you can get a little introduction into the computational side of that. Yeah, those are the main ones, I would say. So pretty
That's
much
really cool.
going through the whole design build cycle of synthetic biology.
And it's so interesting because a lot of those things I've learned about in lecture, but they don't have like a wet lab version of them, and it's like you forget how to like run gel electrophoresis when it's only, a couple of PowerPoint slides. And so at some point you just need to have that practical exposure. Do you think that this practical exposure has made you more interested in applying these techniques, or has it made you maybe wish to be back in like textbooks and doing more theoretical research? Where do you stand now?
Yeah, those first few weeks I was like, I just thought that PhD students would be spending most of their time thinking and reading research papers and designing experiments and so on. But it turns out that, well, at least the experience that I've gotten and what I've got to see, it's completely the opposite. Wet lab work is super time consuming, and they rather spend most of the time there. And that's something that, people who maybe like to think more about the big picture don't like as much, or at least that's what I've seen in the PhD student that I'm working with. And certainly that's something that I experienced as well. I wish that I had more time to work on ideas and then have, I don't know, automated tools that implement those ideas. And I think this is the beauty of coming in as a complete beginner, or at least beginner to wet lab. You can see things with a brand new perspective and think, how can we improve these tools, or how can we even get I don't know, live tools? Because whenever I am genetically modifying something, or inserting a piece of DNA into an organism, I am blind. I don't see that in real time until I conduct like a PCR, gel electrophoresis sequencing, and that's sort of a long time. It's the iteration cycles basically are pretty slow, so it's definitely got me thinking about a lot about the tools and how we can improve them.
It sounds like you're doing really deep market research for future B2B biotech wet lab tools.
Hopefully.
It
No, yeah.
almost sounds like that's what you're doing. You're thinking, okay, what is it like to be the PhD student, and how can I make the lives of the PhD? And I think that's a really beautiful way of thinking about it. Because what if PhDs took 3 years instead of five? Would that bring more people to do PhDs?
Actually, something great. I've been having these similar conversations with other people in the field, and one of them, what he said is, isn't it crazy that actually most people in the biotech field have PhDs? Like, what other fields are like these? Can you really advance an industry up to a point like the tech industry is right now? Can we make like the Googles of biotechnology and the Facebooks and so on if everyone sort of needs a PhD to do these things? So that's one angle. But another one is certainly like, I feel bad again. I feel bad about, seeing all these smart people and all of the ideas that they could bring into fruition, but they just need to spend most of their time just pipetting the same things. And it doesn't stop at pipetting, like, oh, we know about Alpintrus, but like analyzing, I don't know, these seeds or cells they're looking under a microscope in a pretty time-consuming way. And it's just the same protocols, the same repetitive things.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that you say that because when I also reflect on what's happening in other industries, it still feels like that. Like people are working on the small things that don't really matter in the grand scheme. Like if you think about at least my exposure into kind of like the tech world, people spend a lot of times in meetings that just talk about other meetings, or they spend a lot of time doing all these things. And especially this summer when I got a little bit more exposure to governments, diplomacy and the UN and the WHO, and I feel like I got a whole new angle on time-wasting activities in the workplace. Like it's absolutely crazy how we use like these really smart people, but like you said, they're just pipetting the same thing over and over again because they have to. And then it's like, what do you do? But on the other side, do you think, because when I talk to the researchers, it's all about like failing for 7 hours, doing the thing that doesn't actually matter, and then getting the answer. Do you think that there's merit to that pipetting, or do you think it's all like exclusively a waste of time?
Yeah, that's a very important point that actually by not only staying in my own lab, but also, for example, attending meetings at other types of labs, that's when you really get to know, like, also the difference between basic science labs and labs that are trying to build new technology. So, like, for example, for the basic researchers, looking at the microscope is like actually what gives them the insights. You know, it's how they, you know, analyze the behaviors of these organisms. And like, it might sound boring to an outsider, but that's the most exciting. It's their work, you know? So I think that that's one important thing to consider as well.
Is your lab more on the basic side or the technology platform side?
Some more on the technology platform side, actually the whole focus on of the lab. It's not even the applications of these things, which some people are starting to look at, but it's more like the tools, and that's why we actually work with model organisms and not precisely on, say, things like corn.
And remind me, are you, is this an internship that finishes soon? Are you, where are you going next year? What happens next? And how has your trajectory been shifted by this lab work?
Oh, yes. Those are questions that I was even asking myself as I was entering this internship, like, what will change? So this is something that it was initially set to last for 2 months, since I was really enjoying the work, but also really wanted to both gain more value, but also provide more value. I said, okay, like, what are the limits of this visa? So I just am staying for a little bit longer, less than 3 weeks more. Yeah, but that's something that is eventually going to end. I've got some perspective and feedback on what I'm working on with synthetic textiles from these people, because really it's a plant bio project, and these people, you know, they're the experts on this. So that's been interesting to see. And it's also given me, I guess it's also expanding my perspective on what's possible to do with synthetic biology, not only again at this lab, but there are these meetings that are held every 2 weeks in this bioengineering department, and you get to see like what other people are doing in mammalian cells or in the tools themselves. So it's interesting to see that as well. I wouldn't say it's entirely shifted my perspective or where I'm going, but it's enriched this perspective in terms of, again, what other tools, what other things I can do.
And do you see yourself trotting down sort of a more formal educational route or being the first non-PhD biotech person?
Oh, well, that's a question that I still also ponder upon. It's one of the questions that I've asked many, almost everyone I meet in the biotech industry, like, is a PhD necessary? And I think, of course, everyone has their own answer to it. And I think that as I continue to build and learn, that answer is, you know, I'm going to find it by myself. For now, as you know, I'm part of the 776 Fellowship, which requires me, or actually gives me the opportunity to work on this project full time. So that's what I'll be doing for the next couple of years. And from there, I will continue to assess the opportunities and challenges, I guess, in the formal education system for myself.
Was it scary to choose something of, yeah. Tell me about that.
So,
You've been with them for 2 years?
for, say that again?
7 6? Or is that's a recent, yeah.
Yeah, that's recent. I was just elected this year, a couple of months ago. So
Got it.
the most ironic thing is that I really remember this time when I was in middle school. It was the first year of my last year, first day of my last year of middle school. And I was like asking my biology teacher, actually the biology teacher who inspired a lot of these, you know, exciting ideas in me, about advice for my future. And I was like, you know, I just want to do something impactful in the world and so on. And I envisioned myself sort of being this dropout from an Ivy League school and then starting something amazing. You know, that's sort of a very high level aspiration that I had for myself. So the idea was there, you know, taking an unconventional path. And eventually, of course, I figured out that universities are a very concentrated environment for knowledge, and they have like the resources, the facilities, so it'd be a good idea to try that out as well. And then, you know, I even applied to the Teal Fellowship like 2 years ago or something, just blindly. But then when the 776 Fellowship opportunity arose for the first time in 20, well, 1 year ago, the first cohort they had, I just applied, because like, why not? But still, I was very scared to leave school or actually skip it because I was just finishing high school. And how that looked like was like, I don't even know what I want to do. Like, it was just like a lot of uncertainty. I knew I wanted to sort of take a gap year to figure out how much more progress I could make on my own. But then, it's just scary. I think that people who are scared of taking gap years or dropping out or skipping whatever, they know what it feels. So I don't need to explain that. And then the reason I decided to take this opportunity this time, it was mainly because I'd been working on the project more time, and I knew that this would actually be an opportunity to take it further, So it made a little bit more sense.
So you're still not applying for this application cycle, and you're just going to keep rolling. That's the
Oh,
plan.
you mean like,
Universities?
no, not for now. I mean, I guess, yeah, not for now.
It's such a good point too, because I find that, at least my experience at a university, is that even if I want to do a lot of things, sometimes the gravitational pull against those things is really, really strong, that it makes me lose my conviction. And it makes me feel lonely in this pursuit of, I just want to build something big. I just want to figure out how to solve a problem and solve a bunch of them, kind of thing. And sometimes it feels like I'm the only one thinking like it. And like you said, I know that there's research, I know that there's smart people, I know that these things exist on the campuses. But sometimes when you feel like such a loner or like such a small sample of this highly concentrated phenomenon, I think it gets really hard too, even if there are resources to support. So I guess in your case, I'm curious how you meet the community and how you maintain your kind of sanity in like choosing this direction.
I really like how a fellow young person building something, he's, Mexican and has really inspired me for many years. His name is Julian Rios. And he says, birds just fly, fish just swim. So like they don't need to be told, they don't need to be thinking about this, they just do it. So it sort of comes back to like Nike's also slogan, right? If you were born to do it, you just do it, right? So yeah, I guess when you just want to do something, I guess you just do it. Like I don't see myself pursuing anything else than biotech or entrepreneurship. So I guess that really just finding that thing that you would just be doing in any case. That's a question that I actually like to ask some of my previous college classmates. I was like, if biotech didn't exist at all, what would you major in, or what would you be doing? Like, if this was not your default scenario. And some of them said, well, I would be doing cotton confection, or I would be playing basketball, or I would be a musician, etc. And it was very interesting to see that. And the answer to why they're actually doing what they're doing is because either, they know that it's safe in terms of their financial future or their professional career or what their parents say, what other people think, etc. And for me, it was like, I don't know. I generally have no idea. If I was not doing biotech, I would probably, or if I was not in college, I would be doing projects on my own. And if I was not doing biotech, I have no idea what I would be doing. So I'm really doing the best thing that I know I can do, the thing that I love the most. And that's what keeps me going. But in terms of the social circle, I mean, we're just having this conversation right now, and I don't need to be like your college classmate or whatever. And similar with people that I meet on Twitter, I think it's an amazing platform to just get to know interesting people and have casual conversations with them. So just keep reaching out to those people that you find interesting.
And what about living? Do you like living in Palo Alto, California? Do you think it's very different from Mexico? Where do you see yourself living in the next couple of years?
Yeah, that's a question that I've like actively been trying to answer. I love it here. Just like I think the safety part of it is something that I've been looking forward to a lot. Like the fact that I can just go out for a run at 10 p.m. at night, and like I'm sure that I'll be okay. At least maybe it's not right to do that, but I just do it and I love it. So that's a big part of it. I love the nature. I love the fact that I can just go to San Francisco and meet someone interesting every weekend, or that I can attend different events. And Stanford itself, you know, a place with almost infinite amount of people that come and go, who you can again have interesting conversations with. However, it depends on who my customer will be in the end and what resources that I need. In the end, I've also figured out that a lab is a lab, and as long as you set it up in a right way, the only constraint might be the time that things take to be shipped to you. And in my case, well, I'm working with plants, so I guess the environment, I could build like a building, actually a greenhouse, you know, that's indoors, you know. So yeah, the environmental conditions, and then, you know, for example, things here like primers and things for sequencing and so on. It's just like a one day thing, whereas in Mexico, like iGEM teams, for example, struggle a lot because they need to wait for months to get things shipped to them, and sometimes like the own borders and regulations. I once wanted to get like DNA shipped from actually from Stanford to my house to do some biohacking, and then it got stopped, you know, customs office. So that's something that I'm still trying to figure out, but I'll let you know.
Wow. It's crazy. It's just one country away, and these aren't even like these aren't you're not missing smart people, you're not missing difficulty of knowledge. It's literally logistics. It's just a little bit, it's not even the time, it's like it's literally like cars on a road, and that's the problem. Like, that to me is absolutely insane, that we have smart, awesome people and cars on the road is what's stopping them from building cool shit.
I would say, well, cars on the road, yes, but also, you know, the regulations of each country are part of it as well. So, yeah, it's both like the, I guess, political and technical infrastructure. I don't know.
But do you feel a strong connection with the Mexican biotech community, or do you feel more of a stronger connection with the US one?
That's my fault because, you know, ever since I started to connect with people on Twitter and build my network and so on, I reached out to way, way more people, you know, in other countries than in Mexico. So definitely, I know way more people in biotech in the US and not many in Latin America, unfortunately. But that's something that I've been changing. Even, you know, you sometimes find Latinos who are building and working and studying in the US, and it's great to see that cultural exchange, I guess. But yeah, it's I would say in terms of differences, yeah, I mean, as you say, I think it's not human capital that makes the difference, but it's more like the infrastructure. So I have definitely met very smart people in Mexico working on interesting things too.
That's awesome. It's so interesting. So I was when I was in Singapore, I spent a lot of time studying Indonesia's like fintech and emerging tech scene. And then one day I was thinking about Mexico and Latin America, and I was like, for some reason, I'm just getting a hunch that Mexico is kind of like Indonesia, like it's like the Indonesia of Latin America. And then I did some research. There's this like, do you know BRICS? It's
Break.
Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And they recently expanded to BRICS Plus, and it's sort of like ASEAN or the EU, like a coalition of countries, like non-Western powers. But there's also, I learned this, like I was just Googling like Mexico and Indonesia similarity comparison. Turns out like smart economists came together and they were like, we're gonna make another group under BRICS, a different one called MINT, Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, Turkey. And I was like, never taken an economics class in my life, and I've like pseudo predicted like an economic trend from like 2010 of like these cool emerging fragmented huge markets. And generally, like the comparison is that they are such big markets with a lot of human capital that's young and super diverse and just like big geographically. And I was like, I felt so smart. And I messaged you because I was like, I want to hear your perspective on how the Latin, and I know you write some amazing blogs too on the topic. So I'm curious, just from like a cultural perspective, have you been able to find a lot of identity in the Latinam startup scene? Do you see yourself kind of shifting more that way? And what are you excited about, like, for the region?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, I think when I first started to ask myself this question was actually when I decided to pursue on my undergrad degree in Mexico rather than the US. And I was like, okay, there are many positive things that I saw in the US. Like, what are some of those things that I can find in Mexico? What are the challenges and the opportunities? And some of them I've already mentioned in terms of the infrastructure. I think that just like in terms of identity, I would first put it on the biotech side. So looking at all the biodiversity that we have and all the culture that's here, I think, of course, I identify myself more with that, but also I feel like we have a greater richness of that in Latin America than probably in other places. But in terms of actually involving myself in that community, I think again, it's something that I'm guilty of and that I'll have to probably, explore further in the future. And it totally depends on, I'm currently doing, customer exploration. So who am I selling my products to, or what kinds of biological inputs am I having? I know certainly people in the space, people building biomaterials in Mexico from many different types of plants or even fungi. So I've got to know people, and I think, yeah, I will continue to explore that as I dive into the next couple of years. But right now, I
Yeah.
wouldn't have a very concrete answer, unfortunately.
In a conversation with a Canadian and building a biotech company in Boston, I was asking him about why the US? Like, why do when you have Canada, like, I mean, it's kind of the opposite end of you guys. And he and I had a long conversation about Canada, Europe, and the lack of early stage capital for biotech companies, and specifically how that kind of limits the risk that you can take. And when we're doing wet lab, like these experiments, they are inherently very risky, high failure rate, in a very different way than say, hey, I want to fund you to do a SaaS tool. That is a lot more predictable. I'm just curious on this topic specifically of early stage capital. Do you think that there's really that much of an advantage in the US? And what other opinions do you have on the topic?
Well, I do gotta say that the startup founders, biotech startup founders that I've seen in Mexico and Latin America, they have a lot of foreign external funding from, other countries rather than, actual VCs based in Mexico or Mexican people. That said, however, there is this, the best example that I know of is this biotech VC firm. They actually call themselves company builders for specifically biotech and life sciences. They're called Grytics. And I actually wrote like a series of articles for them recently interviewed.
I saw this on your
Yeah,
LinkedIn.
I recently interviewed the managing partner of that fund. And yeah, I think they're a great example of the things that are possible there given the capital certainly, but I think there's a lot missing, whereas they could probably be seen as the indie bio of Latin America, but at the same time, they're just like the very early starting phase. They take business people, they take scientists who've never even sometimes thought about starting a biotech company, and then they make that happen. However, later on, at least the most successful examples that I've seen coming out of Grytics, they go on to IndieBio, they go on to other accelerators in the US, they go on to raise larger rounds from other people. So I think, yeah, in terms of early stage, that's where we are at. I had the chance to also sit down and chat with the founder of the first cultivated meat company in Mexico, and
Amazing.
probably one of the first, if not the first in Latin America, and they did get their funding from a Mexican VC firm. So that was interesting to see. But it's I think that the way they do that, like the framework, is very different to, I guess, VC in the US, because it's sort of a partnership. Like, yeah, it's just different. It's not like the I'll need to look more into that, but yeah. Few examples still.
Yeah, cool. Do you see your customers being in Latin America, North America, Europe, where, or you're kind of like agnostic?
Yeah, for now I guess that there are two ways to look at this. When I was taking some you could call them entrepreneurship courses. It was, part of my university's program. They were telling me, like, yeah, it doesn't matter if you don't scale up right now as much. You can just like make little things for artisans, or sell it as a premium product and have that maybe cultural component, and you can make have a lower output, but then have that be a luxury slash premium brand that you create. But that's not as attractive to me. I think what I actually want to do is like have the largest impact possible. So like, yeah, I guess there are these two models, and the other one would actually be working on the scaling up, lowering the unitary price, and later on, actually selling to the largest brands possible. And it's I'm not, I like to actually mention brands and companies such as Ruby Laboratories. They are partnering with really, really large brands such as Walmart to actually scale these technologies. Other people, I actually, well, briefly chatted with another Mexican founder and Teal Fellow, who's looking even at medical companies that she can sell this to. So there are many different routes. For me, I'm focusing on fashion brands right now. One of the latest, like earliest actually, sort of customer discovery experiences was actually being discovered through my crowdfunding campaign by some people working at the H&M Foundation, seeking sustainability solutions, or I guess sustainable clothing. So I had conversations with them, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that too.
And I think it's a really ripe topic. I think the world is getting much more consumerized towards sustainable products. And I think, yeah, I think you're onto something really, really impactful, which is awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm curious, let's go back to some of those business model scenarios, because when you were saying that, what it reminded me of was Paul Graham's essay on Airbnb, where he talks about how the thing that struck him in the YC interview was how they made a cereal brand to pay off their credit card bills. Like, they just, throughout making Airbnb, they had like a binder this big of all their credit card bills. And at one point, they were just going to go bankrupt. And so they made like custom cereal. Like, what? So interesting. And so, what do you think are going to have to be the custom cereal that you might have to make in the journey? The things that aren't, obviously, that's not building Airbnb, but what? Have you had to do anything like that? You mentioned crowdfunding, but what are kind of the things that you might have to do to stay afloat for the beginning?
Yeah, I see that. I think I've thought about it this in a different way. So looking at sort of proxy products such as cultivated meat, or even vertical farming, which I guess right now people are increasing their skepticism on these different technologies, which I think is actually great. And my question was, what's gonna be my plant-based? So like some companies, lab-grown meat companies, are starting with plant-based products, including this Mexican company startup that I chatted with, or hybrid versions of that. So I think there are certainly many options. One of them is, for example, looking at what are some plants that they are, leave certain waste with them, and what are some resources we can capture from that and turn into these sustainable textiles. What are, the costs? One question there is, what are the main cost drivers in that process of transforming this bio waste and concentrating the compounds that we actually care about? Another very interesting thing that people are doing with cell cultivated plants is in the cosmetics and beauty industry overall. So I think there's this company called Ayana Bio that's deriving many, many compounds for even longevity and vitamins and whatnot from plant cell cultures. So that was interesting, like to think, okay, if I'm already creating this plant cell culture in vitro, what if I could not only create fibers, but, and this is what plants do, naturally. They not only give you fruits, they also produce medicine, they also produce antimicrobial compounds. So like, how can we see, I really have this vision of plants as platforms. So how can we make that more efficient by doing it directly in vitro? And yeah, what are some other things that we can derive from that have higher margins?
Yeah. Two things. First of all, I think what you mentioned earlier about hybrid lab-grown meat is super important. Like when I went to a recent event in Singapore a couple months ago, that was like the big topic of conversation is how can you get a commercialization strategy that makes the most sense? It doesn't make the most sense to do the super expensive induced pluripotent cell that they use gene editing and blah, blah, blah. It, like, if you can do with half of the really expensive bit and then half of the non-expensive bit, that's a really great go-to-market strategy. The second thing this one I want to ask you about, you said that it's good that we've started to introduce skepticism to these new technologies. Tell me more about that. I would love to hear.
Yeah, well, I was writing last year a research paper. It was so crazy because we know, like, I think many people who've heard about lab-grown meat have heard about the challenges. You know, they've heard about, oh, we're not going to be able to even provide 1% of the world supply of meat, or like energy is a big constraint. If we don't use sustainable energy, it doesn't make sense. Or the growth media, either it's too expensive or we're using things that are unethical, even though nobody's using FDS these days. And imagine that somebody reaches out to me. This graduate student from Johns Hopkins group, the alternative protein group at Johns Hopkins, supported by the Good Food Institute. And they're like, yeah, we're writing this paper on the challenges and opportunities, the economical, technical, and social challenges and opportunities of the cultivated meat industry. But guess what? In developing nations, in low-income and developing nations, like LMIC. And I was like, well, you know, I love to, you know, have this experience to sort of dive more into the topic, but I also see it as very out there, you know, like, are we even going to be able to bring these technologies into countries like Mexico, not to say others, like in the African continent, for example, or others? And one of those things that I learned there is some of the things after writing that, so, you know, the things that I learned I've already mentioned, you know. But afterwards, I started to see this wave of, like, you know, YouTube videos saying, yeah, we're not going to be able to provide the demand and so on. And like people calling it, even at events, I think I was at South by Southwest and there was this adjacent event on, yeah, alternative proteins and so on, and people calling it fake meat and so on. And I think that marketing actually plays a big role in that. You know, how do people perceive this product? So I started to see, rather than this sort of bio enthusiasm, the other side of the coin, interacting also with the people who are against these things, and not only consumers, but also people who actually are in the business of growing things like cotton or growing things like meat, and getting to know about their perspective. Because of course, when disruptive technologies like this come, of course you want to, they're going to sort of try to defend their own businesses. So yeah, that's generally what my experience has been there, but I think that skepticism is actually great because it actually forces us to explain these technologies in a better way. There was this really great podcast in the Olin podcast with this guy, David Friedberg, I think, and Shamath and the other guys were really, really poking holes into his understanding or his explanation on what the challenges are. They were like, yeah, but like, are these limits physical limits of biology that we need to cross, or like, yeah, why is it when you talk about scaling up, it just becomes a buzzword? So we need to scale up, you know, and you don't really understand what that means. What are, you know, the most expensive cost drivers? What are the costs, fixed costs of bioreactors? It's just like, I think the technology itself can be seen from incredibly many different angles, but skepticism is great because we actually are forced to answer these questions, not only explain them, but actually answer them through results.
That's the insight that I didn't quite catch the first time, but definitely it was what I was looking for. So I'm really glad you pointed that out. Now I want to flip it to you. What is the skepticism that you've been getting, and what is the thing that you have to get better at explaining it?
Yeah, one thing that people ask at the very beginning is, why lab-grown cotton? You know, like, what's wrong with it? Plants absorb CO2, don't they? And then you need to explain, yeah, well, they also use lots of fertilizers, which involve in 3% of the world's greenhouse gases, and that's something actually a PKS project that I did with some other friends working on biofertilizers. But yeah, that's one thing. Then water consumption. So if we're using fresh water for these plants, cotton is actually one of the most water-intensive crops. I think it's 10,000 liters of water per kilogram of crop. And then, you know, overall, what we see or what I see is that even though, yes, plants are platforms and you don't need to give them anything that's not already natural, like soil and water and sun to grow, the weight, the output that you actually have, the percentage in weight of the plant that's actually the product that you care about ends up being less than 10% for something, less than 1% actually for something like cotton. And similar for other products, we can talk about wheat, we can talk about rice, maize, the grains, then there's fruits and many, many other products. And so, yeah, that kind of makes sense for people. But then what are the challenges? You know, if we've been actually growing cotton fibers in a petri dish for decades for scientific research purposes, then why don't we have lab-grown textiles? Why is my shirt not made out of lab-grown cotton, right? And the answer to that ends up being two things. One of them is that the growth media, again, is very expensive because just as in lab-grown meat, we've been using this just for research. So, like, yeah, the process of creating all these growth hormones, it's not optimized, for example. Or, like, sometimes the growth media that we use, it was tried for different purposes, but sometimes even for other plants. So, like, the MS media, this is a problem that I was looking at the other day, the MS media, which is something that is used to culture many, many different plants, it's not all of them in vitro, was created for the tobacco plant specifically. And then we are just using this and it works, but what if we could optimize it? Maybe we don't need all of this components, which are dozens of them, it's just like the FDS of plants. What if we don't need this to culture cotton fibers in vitro, to culture other things? So that's in the growth media side of things. And then on the other side, it's the stem, what I call the stem cells problem. So plants are wonderful in that you can cut them and they regenerate. And then the challenge is, you know, if I can take any plant cell from this plant and turn it into cotton fibers, the question is, what are the biochemical buttons that I need to press in order to do that, and in order to do that in the most efficient way? Because right now what we can do is one step before the cotton fibers, we take those cells and they become the fibers. Now the question is, how can we go many steps behind that, take any cell from the plant and turn it into the fiber, for example?
Very similar challenge to a lot of lab-grown meat. But I think what was the coolest part of your explanation was when you were like, the FBS of plants. And you start to see a problem like FBS, which you're exactly right, that most places aren't using it, but also at the expense of the growth of their cells.
Yeah.
Right. They've kind of removed it because it's economically burdensome, and then it's ethically burdensome. And then it's also just exactly what you were saying too, like research and application have two totally different incentive systems.
Yeah.
In the same way, this is an analogy that really resonated with me when I was more head deep into lab-grown meat, which is that in medicine, it does not matter if it costs $10 million or $1 million to make a heart. If it costs $10 million, and let's say you only have $10 million, you can have one heart, or if it costs $1 million, you can now have 10 hearts. But in lab-grown meat or in cotton or in all these materials, it does matter. You cannot just make $10 million lab-grown cotton. In fact, you probably could already make that. That's probably not the challenge. Yeah. The challenge is that you need to have less than $10 million to make, you know, an actual product that matters.
Exactly.
This is where the economics. Well, before we get into rapid fire, is there anything else that you want to touch on, jam out about in terms of like life, work, personal explosions?
Not really. I think we've definitely explored many topics, so I'm glad about that.
Okay, amazing. I'm gonna pull up the rapid fire and let's see your thoughts. First one. Yeah. What's the next big thing that not a lot of people are working on?
I think that's the hardest one. But I would say I have this Notion page with things that I want to explore myself that I find interesting. One of them is bioelectricity, and that I actually discovered thanks to my friend Amy Lee, TKSR2, and she was just crazy about this fact that you can control the shape pretty much of an organism just like by modifying the ion channels in them. And Michael Levin is sort of the best known researcher nowadays in terms of that. So yeah, I would say that. But outside of that, something that caught my attention recently is seeing neurons as chips, like building chips with neurons and like computing with actual human or mammalian neurons. I think that's crazy.
Totally agree. And I might throw in a few ones. I know I sent you a few before, but actually one that came to my head just now. I want to know one thing that you really want to do in the next 6 months.
One thing that I really, really want to do. I think run a marathon. I will say run a marathon. Yeah. I've run half marathons. Actually, one of the first things that I did when coming here was doing that. But yeah, I'll push that further.
Love it. And actually, let's do a follow up. What's a place that you want to go in the next 6 months?
Yes. I don't know if this will actually be possible in the next 6 months because I don't have a, you know, an actual plan for it. But something that's always, or for a long time, been in my bucket list is to visit Iceland. I just find it fascinating. Yeah.
Me too. I went through the Iceland airport on my way to North America recently, and it was literally the best hot dog I've had in my entire life. It was the most, no, it was so random, but the most exceptional experience. And I had just come off of two planes and I was just like so tired, and then like go to the market and I get a hot, it was amazing. Oh my god,
that's such a out of all the things about Iceland, I would have never thought about their hot dogs, but
and you should be excited. Oh my where in South America do you want to go?
What's in your bucket list? I think it might be pretty cliche, but Machu Picchu in Peru, that might be a very interesting place to visit. I'm curious about Brazil, too, just because of its biodiversity. But yeah, again, yes, that too.
Me too. I was looking at flights for Patagonia for fun, and I was like, not on this wallet right now, but maybe. Who is someone that's inspiring you a lot right now?
That's a good question. I think I will mention TKS people and non-TKS people. So TKS people, definitely Alishka. I actually listened to her previous podcast and just met her in San Francisco the other day. Timuchin, I think he's doing crazy stuff as well. Yeah, those are two people off the top of my head right now. And non-TKS people, I'll actually mention Neri Oxman. I was listening to her podcast with Lex Friedman this morning, and I find her work as, you know, her the artistic part of her work inspiring, but then it's sort of a bit disappointing to see that it's more speculative than practical so far. Mm-hmm. And who else? Manu Prakash, definitely the lab that I recently mentioned a few minutes ago here at Stanford. I think that guy, wow, like he's just... He just adds so much value. Like, people who add value and people who deploy things and, like, seem to be just putting more things out there than what they consume from the world, that's just incredibly inspiring to me.
Yeah. When you say that he adds value, do you have a couple of examples?
Yes, for sure. So the thing that people know him the most for is frugal science, so basically low-cost, instruments to do science, the most famous one being Foldscope, which is a microscope that costs less than, I guess, $1 or something like that. And it's just a lens and, you know, to basically magnify things, but then you sort of move it using paper and then you can attach it to your phone and then you can take pictures of that. And there are so many angles to see that because he sees it through the physics lens where he needs to prove through equations like how this works or like how to optimize it, whatever. How can you actually make it cheap and make it almost as good as an actual, like the microscopes that are used here at Stanford or at any other research lab. But then he's also like, wow, he shows videos of people looking through the Foldscope for the first time or even looking at a microscope through a microscope for the first time, and they go like, wow. And he's like, you hear that? That is the sound of people thinking. That is what it sounds like. And like, just like that insight, that mind-blowing moment. It's not only the insight, it's not only the mind-blowing moment, it's also people who are like, oh, okay, you have this disease, but you've never seen it. You've never seen what a microbe, what a virus or whatever, you know, looks like, what a bacteria looks like. So like, how can you expect people to believe in that, just like they believe in God, when you're not showing that to them? So he really thinks that it's a transformational moment when you actually show people things like microorganisms under a microscope. That's just one of them. And then he has like this crazy thing. His PhD thesis was like, it's called bubble logic. So like actually creating logic gates out of pure fluids. So like water with oil and dye, and you can actually make those experiments in your house and see like, it's fantastic. Yeah.
Wow. No, that is exceptional. So, okay, this is going to be a little bit of a train of thought. Bear with me.
Yeah.
What that reminded me of, it's like his quirky thing, his like frugal science.
Yeah.
Now, let's imagine that we are hosting an event where everyone comes and they have to showcase something. But it can't be like directly, like you're not pitching yourself. It is just like a fun event. So if someone knows how to juggle, they can like share a juggle lesson. Or if someone makes a really good apple pie, they can like bring a great apple pie. Or if someone is an amazing singer, they can do some a cappella. What do you think your thing would be?
that's so cool. No, yeah, I think obviously I would love for it to be like my cotton fibers or whatever textiles I'm working with. So that would be one thing. But if I had to choose another one, you know, I love writing. So like coming up with, I don't know, or photography, even the photos that I take of trees and so on. So like, yeah, I think those would be what I would bring.
Really fun.
That's a good question, actually. You should ask it at the end of other podcasts.
Yeah, I just came up with it. So we've talked a lot about what you're good at, and you're good at many, many things. But what is something that you love doing, but you're bad at?
Coding.
But you love it. Do you do a lot of it? Or?
No. And I think I've got better at it. But yeah. That's the one thing that I say, if I had a magic wand to make myself good at anything, it would be coding. And I don't have much trouble with like back-end stuff and using the terminal and things like that and Python. But then with front-end stuff, I love design. I love, you know, even making, you know, Figma designs of apps and so on. But then when it comes to actually putting that, I just don't understand CSS, you know, and people are like, that's not even a programming language, but it's so like non-intuitive to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I was rebuilding my website this weekend, and I similarly have struggles with front end, and I was just like, oh. So I totally agree.
Yeah.
Actually, this kind of piggybacks nicely. What would be a piece of advice you would give to your 13-year-old self? Would it be to learn CSS?
No. I think learn the fundamentals of things and focus on that. Focus on cultivating yourself on the inward part of it. Like, I think I started networking at a good age, which is such a weird phrase to say. Like, I was someone who was... I didn't used to appreciate things like my arts classes or my Spanish classes as much, or even my physics classes. You know, I used to see them as boring and things that I was not interested in. I was just like, I just want to do biotech and biology, and I didn't appreciate those things as much. But now what I see is that it's just like the intersections in TKS, you know, building your T. You can build your T with blockchain and biology, but you can also build your T in art and robotics, you know. And actually that's an insight from many different people in history, but most notably Steve Jobs, right, which is mentioned a lot in Isaacson's biography. People building at the intersection of art and science are just like crazy.
Yeah, recently I've really tried to adopt the philosophy that everyone and everything has some form of value. It's just that they're present at different concentrations. So if we were looking at like a huge rock and there's a little bit of gold, like that definitely has value. And there's a process to chip at that. And like you'll learn a lot by trying to get a really small amount of gold. But also if I give you like a gold, you know, block that you don't have to chip at, that also has a lot of value, or you can like make jewelry or whatever. And so just realizing that every single thing in life you can gain something from, and often it is just like revamping your mindset. And it's hard too, because then like sometimes I've struggled to have boundaries with that too. For example, I was on a call a couple of weeks ago, and it was clearly one that was like the other person, it wasn't like a good use of anyone's time. And I was like, okay, well, by the philosophy, I want to assume that everyone has value and there's something I can learn here. But within 20 minutes, I was like, there's no point in this being an hour call. Like, I have other things that have other values. Anyway, now I'm like ranting, but I think it's a hard thing to balance, but it's still a really beautiful thought to be like, how can I sit through the boring physics lecture realizing that maybe it's an analogy I can use later? Okay, sorry, one more random question, then we'll do the final wrap-up.
Yeah.
What language do you want to learn other than Spanish and English?
Chinese.
Chinese. Are you in the process of learning, or?
No, I downloaded Chinese the app one weekend, learned a couple of characters, and then never picked it up again. So I think if I allocated more time to it, or, you know, yeah, that would be the language. But right now, I won't do it.
Yeah.
It's not something I'm actively working on.
Yeah, maybe someday in the future, but their biotech is definitely booming. So it's
yeah.
Spanish, Chinese, you're going to like be able to speak with over half the world.
Exactly. Isn't it crazy? Yeah. You know, actually, something that I'll mention too is after my first week here doing research, I said, you know, biology is actually a language too. So I want to learn how to speak its language, and that's something that I'm working on as well.
Honestly, this is an opinion that I had for a really long time, is that like every single subject is just a language. It's just
yeah.
Like, what language do you care about? Like, if you learn physics, math equations are part of it. Like, everything is just a language. Like,
yeah.
History is a language. Studying modern or Renaissance art, like, those have two totally different vocabularies and grammatical structures and, you know, conventions and slang. Like, everything's language. Okay, one last question. What is something that every person should experience once in their lifetime, at least once in their lifetime?
Oh, many things come to mind. One of them is doing something that scares you a lot. Another thing is creating something of your own, something that you're really, really, really proud of. Yeah, I'll stick with those two.
Yeah. What's the scariest thing you've done so far?
I think it's somehow leaving college for the to work on my project full time. That's one thing. Recently, a thing that I did was telling someone who I know is super skeptical about the cultivated meat industry and like an actual professor here, telling them like, what do you think about, you know, cultivated cotton and cultivated fruits, which actually some companies are working on, and having them say, I think it's a stupid idea. And I was sitting in front of them and just like listening to that comment and thinking like, okay, I'll just, you know, and they're not working on anything similar, which, you know, they were also acknowledging that. And that was a bit scary.
Yeah. But honestly, sometimes it's good to have a few haters, a few people who, because it's like the other question that we didn't get a touch on maybe for another podcast is like, why now? Like, why is this the thing to work on now? And why has no one done it yet? Often because sometimes it's just too radical, there's too many haters, and there's no one who has the right incentive structure. And so haters is not always a bad thing, you know?
Yeah, if everybody, even, I don't know if there was a famous artist who said this or a contemporary one, if it's not radical enough, like if everyone, actually, Rick Rubin, on his book, The Creative Act, he was like, if everybody loves it, you're not being creative enough. You're not pushing the boundaries as much. If everybody hates it, well, I don't know what that case looks like. But then if you have, you know, a couple of haters, a couple of lovers, and might, you know, it's kind of mediocre maybe. So, yeah, you'll want to have more haters sometimes too.
Yeah. Or people who are just totally indifferent. Like, think about CRISPR now, a lot more people know about, but CRISPR 4 years ago. Or AI, ChatGPT, like I remember learning about OpenAI in 2019. And then like so when it happened, I was in university still, and I like showed people ChatGPT, and so many people come up to me, they're like, you're the person who introduced me to ChatGPT. And I'm like, wow, that's like such a random, you know, I just like happened to know about it. But like even in December when I started introducing people to ChatGPT, they thought it was so cool. So it's like interesting. Some things just don't have the popular swing of things. You just have to be ahead of the curve. Well, why don't we just end off on any book that you love or any book that you're reading right now?
The book that I would always, that I always recommend to anyone, regardless of their background or interests, is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari. I know that for you it might be Sapiens. Is it right?
So all three. My order is Sapiens and 21 and then Homo Deus, but honestly, they're all phenomenal.
Yeah. That's amazing. And then what I'm currently reading. Oh, you know a very good one I read last month was The Scientific Elixir, Scientific Freedom, The
Oh,
Elixir of Civilization. Yes.
yeah, I've heard of it. I've heard of it. I haven't read it, so maybe I'll put that one on my list.
Yes, it's published by Stripe Press, and it was written by this guy who's a researcher at UCL. That's, yeah, it's very cool.
Phenomenal. Well, thank you so much, Sophia. I've had so much fun having you here.
Cool.
I think people are going to really, really enjoy listening to your story. But thanks so much. All the best.
Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.